From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. As a child, when I visited my home country of India, I sometimes got to witness the amazing Hindu religious spectacles that unfolded on the streets of Mumbai. One of the most striking was the last day of the Ganesh Chaturthi festival, where masses of people would carry giant idols of the Hindu elephant-headed god Ganesh and march toward the sea and submerge the idols in the water as a symbolic gesture. I always wondered what happened to the idols in the days and weeks following. Asking the question of what happens when religious practices and environmentalism collide is my guest, Jay Wexler. He is a professor at the Boston University School of Law, where he has taught environmental law and church-state law since 2001, and he's just written a new book that's called When God Isn't Green, A Worldwide Journey to Places Where Religious Practice and Environmentalism Collide. I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Jay Wexler.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, first, tell me about the journey that you undertook to write this book. How did it all start? It's kind of an unusual topic to research.
Yeah, well, it was a long journey to get to the topic, I have to say. I wrote a book a bunch of years ago called Holy Hullabaloos, which involved traveling around the United States to visit places where church, state, Supreme Court cases came from. And I learned that I really liked visiting places where the controversies kind of came from, so I could talk to the people and really understand what was going on the ground. But one thing I did not get to do on that for that book is I talk to any Native Americans and kind of investigate any Native American controversies over church and state. So when I finished the book, I was looking for cases involving Native Americans, and I came across this fascinating area of law involving bald and golden eagle feathers, which are the issue there is that many Native Americans and Native American tribes need to use bald eagle or golden eagle feathers as part of their religious ritual, but it happens to be illegal under the Bald Eagle Act of 1940 to possess any kind of feather of any eagle in the United States. So what to do? And what the United States government did was create this agency called the National Eagle Repository, which basically collects dead bald eagles, processes them, and sends the feathers and other parts out to Native Americans who have applied for them. So I thought that was fascinating, and I visited that place. And I actually wanted to write a book all about bald eagles. I thought they were fascinating, but nobody wanted to publish a book about bald eagles, as it turned out. No matter how many proposals I wrote or how much I begged, nobody was wanting to publish that book. So I was talking to my editor at Beacon Press, and she asked me, might there be kind of a bigger story here that the bald eagle is an example of? And I sighed because all I wanted to do is write this book about the bald eagle. And I said, wow, I don't know, how about religious practices that harm the environment? And I looked up at her and she was smiling, finally. And she said, now that's interesting. Are there other examples of religious practices that harm the environment? And I had a few in my head because I've taught these two classes for a long time. And so whenever a religious issue came up in environmental law or vice versa, I remembered them. So I said, I think there are, and I'll go do some research. And sure enough, it turned out that there were quite a few practices that I could investigate, religious practices that harm the environment.
So you went and you traveled around the world. You went to India, and that features heavily in your book. And I'm not surprised that India has these, is so prominent among these examples, because I've seen firsthand how zealous, Indian Hindus are about their rituals and how massive and spectacular they are. There are multiple grand festivals throughout the year. So explain what you saw in India around the Ganesh festival that I opened with. What indeed does happen to the idols after the festival is over?
Yeah, I wish I could have spent more time in India. It was unbelievable. I had never been there before. And I spent about a week in Mumbai and during the festival. And I showed up a few days into the festival, and I basically wandered around Mumbai and to the places where the really, really big, amazing, extravagant Ganesh idols were. And as you know, I mean, there are millions of people who go and worship these idols throughout the entire week, and it's really exciting, and they're beautiful to look at. And then at the end of the week, as you pointed out, they bring them to the sea, and there's this incredible day of ritual and chanting and colors and singing, and it's glorious, except then the idols just are taken out to sea and left there, which is an amazing sight, I have to say. It's sort of like the Rose Bowl parade, if it ended, you know, at the Pacific Ocean, but then it just kept on going into the sea. That's kind of what it was like. And what happens to them is they sort of deteriorate, they break up, there have been studies that show that they pollute the water, and they harm the ability for marine life to live in the water. It's very interesting. I went the next day, the next morning, to see what the damage was on the beach, and it's a much sadder scene than the day before, because you know there are no people except for a lot of policemen and a few college students who are volunteering to clean the place up, and there are like these parts of the Ganesh idols washing up, and they're gray because the paint has been washed off, and they're broken, and they just sort of litter the beach, and I tried to take a picture, but the police were not having any of that. They told me I had to put my cameras away because it could cause a controversy if I took a picture. But it was a pretty sad scene the next day, I have to say.
There's also the Indian festival of Holi, which marks springtime. This is where people gather in the streets. They smear one another with these bright jewel-toned colored powders. They also get very drunk and high while doing it, and it's a lot of fun. But as you point out in your book, the powders they use are really toxic. And by the way, the practice of Holi is actually spreading to other countries, minus the sort of Hindu significance. And so it's just, I don't know exactly how toxic all of the powders are that people use in other parts of the world. But in India, at least, what are these powders made up of? They're not like edible, right?
No, I think they used to be. I think they used to be made up of spices, and turmeric was used, and other natural things, but now it's much easier and cheaper to use chemicals. I can't remember the names of the chemicals there in the book, but there have been studies done there too, which show that the stuff, you know, it can hurt the skin, but it also gets into the water and causes damage to the water supply, and so it's dangerous too. And there are certainly people who are, as with the Ganesh festival in India, there are people who are pushing for a more eco-friendly or conscious holidays, but I think it seems anyways with the Ganesh example that it's a kind of a long haul before environmental interests are fully incorporated into the ritual.
Then there's the fireworks. Hindus set off fireworks at Diwali, which is also the Hindu New Year. This is also a very popular practice in China at Chinese New Year, and it's kind of a more universal form of celebration. We set off fireworks here in the U.S. on the 4th of July. One could argue patriotism is a form of religion, but most U.S. cities have banned the polluting fireworks, haven't they? And in other parts of the world, they haven't, and it causes a lot of atmospheric pollution, doesn't it?
It does. There's studies on that too that show the effect of the fireworks on the air. And I'm not sure. There are some holidays which involve smoke and things where there have been studies that show increases in hospitalization and emergency room visits and stuff like that. It's not the biggest environmental crisis of our time or anything, but it is. It's something that people ought to consider. I mean, I personally can't stand fireworks. I don't know. My wife and family, they think I'm...
I hate fireworks too. I might be unpopular. You and I might be unpopular, but I can't stand fireworks either. They remind me of bombs.
Yeah, right. They're just really loud and everybody looks in the sky and says, ooh, but I never done it for me.
So basically these are, I mean, the particulate matter that is emitted from fireworks can cause very severe short-term damage, even if, for example, in the grand scheme of climate change, they may not compare to the pollution of coal-fired power plants. When you're setting off fireworks in neighborhoods and the particulate matter and the smoke is being breathed in, that, I'm sure, causes problems, particularly among children, right?
Among children and among sensitive individuals and people with asthma and other, pulmonary issues, it can be really dangerous. I mean, you can have events, that send you to the hospital, resulting from very small amounts of this stuff. And so, right, it is serious at a short-term level for sure.
There's also the Catholic practice of burning palm fronds for Palm Sunday. How widespread a practice is this? In your book, you bring this up as sort of a Central American thing, but isn't it done by Catholics all over the world?
Well, it's not burning. It's just using the palm fronds as part of the Palm Sunday ritual. And so it's not an air problem. It's the problem of deforesting the places where the palms come from. Most people don't really know where their palms for Palm Sunday come from. Whether if you're in the United States or Europe, you show up at the church and there are some palm fronds. But it turns out they come from some very important and endangered forests in Central America, in southern Mexico, in western Guatemala, Belize, and a couple of other places. And the demand for those palms has been so great that for many, many years, and still in many places, the harvesters were under great pressure to harvest a huge amount of palms as fast as they possibly could. And that resulted in basically an unsustainable practice, and the forests were dying, and the forests are used for all sorts of things for the people down there, so it was a big problem. So that's the Palm Sunday issue.
There's also you went to Singapore in your travels for this book. This is a ritual I had never heard of. The people burn something called joss, some kind of fake money.
Right, ghost money. It's not just money. Sometimes during this festival, which is the Hungry Ghost Festival, you can buy not just paper money, but like paper jewelry and paper TVs and paper iPods. And the idea is you burn them as a way of giving thanks to your ancestors and keeping the ancestors happy, so they don't, you know, the ghosts don't get too hungry and cause chaos in the world, because this is the time of the year where the ghosts have access to you know, our part of the world. And so during this 2-week period, there's a lot of burning of the joss paper. It is mostly paper and paper money, and it's an incredible amount in Taiwan and Singapore and Hong Kong. Sometimes it's done right on the street. Sometimes it's done in temples. I went to one place in Hong Kong which was completely unregulated, and there were like a million people on this one day bringing all of their big sacks of paper and paper houses and putting it into this furnace. And the furnace was just belching out this dark, carcinogenic smoke. And I happened to be wearing linen pants that day, which was a mistake. But
Jay, I also want to bring up a related issue, and I'm not sure if you brought this up in your book or not, but I've encountered this a lot. A lot of religious practices involve the burning of incense. And
yes,
here in the United States, it could be there, you know, smudging, where you burn white sage. And it's interesting. My parents burn incense, and they consider it cleansing because it can, you know, mask other bad smells. But you're burning stuff, so there's smoke in the air, and
Absolutely.
People are breathing it in. People in India, and I'm sure other parts of the world, will burn sticks of incense in their house all day long in closed environments where the windows might be closed. They're smelling it. They have it burning in front of their idols. Some churches will burn those as well. How is that cleansing in any way?
It does smell good, right?
It smells great, but, you know, smoking cigarettes feels good.
Well, exactly. That's I didn't look at this in depth, but I did talk to a scientist in Hong Kong who's done research on incense, both mostly in temples, but also just studying sticks of incense and what comes out of the sticks of incense. And he said it is about as dangerous as smoking cigarettes. Absolutely.
Wow.
I mean, as you say, you're basically breathing in the smoke, and the smoke has all sorts of stuff in it that nobody knows, you know, exactly what it is. He even said that they now market ecologically safe incense, but even that turns out to be filled with carcinogens. So
it's like your equivalent of e-cigarettes.
Right. Maybe.
The other aspect of your book that I found fascinating was what happens when you have people from, you know, a particular organized religion moving in vast numbers around the world, giant pilgrimages. And I'm thinking of the biggest one on earth, and that is the yearly pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, where millions, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Muslims from around the world come to one spot on the world. I can imagine that the carbon footprint of their airline flights must be enormous.
I hadn't really thought about the carbon footprint of the airline flights, but that is certainly part of the problem. Anytime you get a million, 100 million, whatever number of people all going to the same place at once, that's going to cause a huge environmental impact on that place. And I think people are starting to recognize that. I mean, there are examples from around the world where big pilgrimage sites have experienced really serious ecological problems. And there is, in fact, a group, kind of a consortium. They call themselves the Eco-Pilgrimage Organization, basically. And they are there to raise consciousness about kind of environmentally friendlier ways to have pilgrimages. There's even a green guide to the Hajj, which recommends, you know, certain things that you should do if you're going to go on the pilgrimage, including, you know, trying to reduce the amount of plastic bottles that you use. That turns out to be like in the wake of one of the Hajj pilgrimages, they found, I can't remember the exact number, millions, you know, of plastic bottles discarded. So there's a lot that can be done with just raising a little bit of consciousness, but there is kind of an inevitable ecological impact that's going to come anytime you have kind of a religious pilgrimage to one place that it's not really ready for a million people.
Right. So finally, Jay, look, I'm an atheist. It's really easy for me to judge religious practices like the ones we've been discussing as being antithetical to the care of the earth. One would imagine that taking care of our environment should be consistent with religion, but it's not, apparently. But at the same time, these are rituals that people take seriously, and I respect that. Is it just a matter of public awareness and education, or do you think it would be impossible to, you know, get Hindus to rethink their practice of submerging giant statues into the already polluted waters of their seas and oceans?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because the point of my book is really not at all to criticize religion, or I'm not, you know, an angry, I am an atheist, but I'm not an angry atheist. And I teach religion, and I respect religion quite a bit, and I believe in religious freedom. So the point of the book is to, as you say, to kind of raise consciousness about the issue and to ask what we can do as a society, both religious people and environmentalists, when we have a clash of these two really important values, religious freedom on the one hand and environmental protection on the other hand, both of which I think are extremely important and don't inevitably conflict, but sometimes do conflict. And when they do, we're forced to address the question of how do we balance the two. And to some degree, there's no, you know, ultimate solution. If we're going to have religious rituals, there will probably be some impact on the environment. But there are some steps we can take to reduce the impact of those rituals. And hopefully, by talking about it and kind of raising people's awareness of the issues, we might make some progress towards reconciling those two important goals.
I mean, one would imagine that there would just be, you know, a few basic issues. When you burn stuff, it's bad for you. When you throw stuff into the sea or in the ocean, it's bad for the sea or the ocean, which in turn is bad for you. You know, polluting our air and our water, you would think would be sort of obvious things, but it is a matter of public awareness. And hopefully, as we have greater environmental consciousness, that starts to permeate people's views of their own religious practices. I want to thank you so much, Jay, for joining us. If you'd like to give out any websites or your social media connections, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have a website at www.jaywex.com, and I tweet at SCOTUS Humor, SCOTUS Humor.
And we'll post those to our website, risingupwithsonali.com. Thank you so much, Jay, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jay Wexler is a professor at Boston University School of Law, where he has taught environmental law and church-state law since 2001. We've been talking about his new book, When God Isn't Green, A Worldwide Journey to Places Where Religious Practice and Environmentalism Collide. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much, and I'll see you next time.